It's with great pleasure now that I welcome our keynote speaker, Professor Mike Hume. Mike is a Professor of Climate Change at the School of Environmental Sciences at the University of East Anglia. He was the founding director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research from 2000 to 2007. His work explores the idea of climate change using historical, cultural and scientific analyses, seeking to illuminate the numerous ways in which climate change is deployed in public and political discourse. His two most recent books are Why We Disagree About Climate Change, Understanding Controversy, Inaction and Opportunity. And with Henry Newford, the edited volume Making Climate Change Work for Us, which is a synthesis of the research findings from the EU Framework 6 Framework Integrating Project Adaptation and Mitigation Strategies. He is the editor-in-chief of the new review journal, Wiley's Interdisciplinary Reviews, Climate Change. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fiona, for the introduction and the invitation to come to this symposium and give me a platform to put across my perspectives on climate change, which over my rather lengthening career of climate change research now, going back to the early 1980s, have changed. And so probably in the remaining years of my active professional life, they may very well change further, just as climate itself is changing. Why We Disagree About Climate Change is the title of my book, and this talk this morning is one way of trying to convey the underlying thinking that has inspired that book. Later at the end of the afternoon, I'm going to give another talk which is an interesting complementary perspective from a more policy, pragmatic point of view. And I hope you can see the connection between those two talks. I'm going to start off with five voices speaking about climate change. One of them says this. It says that climate change is a pivotal issue for Australia. It is real, and it is caused to a significant extent by human activity. Another voice says that we've had huge changes of climate in the past. To think that the very slight variations measured today are a result of human activity is wrong. Or a third voice would say this. It would say, hope that humanity might act to save itself from a climatic catastrophe seems to be draining away. A fourth voice would offer this view. These are not times for blame or accusation. There is a task ahead of all of us to address the climatic outcomes of our avarice and sloth. Or this one, on the balance of probabilities, the failure of our generation on climate change would lead to consequences that would haunt humanity until the end of time. You may or may not recognise who those voices are, but you'll recognise similar types of statements and claims around climate change, whether in Australia, England, America, or any other country, I suggest, in the world today. And it is recognising this diversity of speech and claim that helped to push me into writing my book, Why We Disagree, to try to make sense of these different voices and why climate change, indeed, rather than being something which is converging towards a solution, seems actually to be diverging towards a set of apparently contradictory certainties. Now, I'm going to do two things in this talk. One is to suggest a number of different ways in which we need to study this idea of climate change in society. And then, secondly, to use this idea of framing to see how we can make sense of this diversity of voices that are speaking. So if we are going to study climate change, and this is how I first got into the business way back in the early 1980s, we could start off by looking at what it is that physical natural scientists think is happening. And if we're going to do that, then the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is an obvious place to start. And we might look at these sort of statements. Back in 1990, in the first assessment, the scientists concluded that the warming at that time was broadly consistent with that expected from climate models, but the same magnitude as natural variability, whereas in 2007, most of the warming is very likely due to elevated concentrations of greenhouse gases. But also, in these same assessments, we might also draw attention to these sorts of statements about sea level rise. In 1990, the range projected by 2100 was between 18 and 110 centimetres globally. In 2007, that range seemingly had contracted 18 to 59 centimetres, but with the important qualifier that there is an unknown contribution from accelerated discharge from ice sheet dynamics. And this is a characteristic, it seems to me, of scientific knowledge, that as we understand more about the physical complexity of the planet and how it works, and use that knowledge in order to think into the future in predictive or projective modes, we have these two things going on at the same time. We have increasing confidence that we understand more about the physical functioning of the system, and yet at the same time we have this enduring, if not broadening, uncertainty about actually how that system might unfold. And that is, those two perspectives, I think, are captured in those two statements here. Associated with this work of the IPCC, there has been, of course, an explosion in the volume of published peer-reviewed scholarly articles about climate change. This is just one analysis that would show this exponential increase of articles focusing on climate change over the last 20 or 30 years. So our knowledge, if you can measure knowledge in any numerical index, our knowledge has increased. And yet also, so has our controversies. One of these blew up very close to my own office at the University of East Anglia. Another, a few weeks later, associated with claims of erroneous or ambiguous statements within the IPCC. And controversy around climate change has been an enduring property of the debate, and it's important that we study controversies. They are moments, as Sarah Watmore has suggested, they are moments at which actually we can learn and intervene in particular ways if we understand the dynamics that lead to controversy in the first place. But there are other ways we might study, and indeed need to study, climate change in society. We might look at these sorts of indicators. This is an index of the spot price of carbon on the EU emissions trading scheme back from January 2005. The price of carbon has varied from 30 euros per ton down to a low of 8 euros per ton, and the price fluctuates in response to a variety of political and economic factors. These price fluctuations tell us something about the political and economic dynamics of climate change as it works its way through society. We might also want to study climate change in the way in which it has innovated language. Brigitte Nierlich, my colleague at the University of Nottingham, Professor of Linguistics and Society, has been doing this now for a number of years. Here, just one of her analyses looking at this compound, low carbon. She's in fact examined a whole family of carbon compounds, which could almost populate a small dictionary these days. Indeed, in fact, the OED, Oxford English Dictionary, did adopt carbon neutral as its one of its words of the year of 2006. I didn't know that the OED did words of the year, but everyone does words of the year, or things of the year, don't they, these days? Low carbon accelerated in its visibility just in this particular corpus of world publications since, particularly around about 2005. So there's been innovation in language around climate change. And almost inevitably, there has been an explosion in the variety and volume of literary texts, both fictional and non-fictional, around climate change. By my own informal monitoring of this literature, I estimate that from about one book per week in the English language about 10 years ago, there is now being published about one book per day on climate change, just in the English language alone. And you can have climate change whichever which way you would like to have it. You can have climate change in architecture and forests, aviation, gender, children, theology, agriculture, philosophy, energy. You can have climate change in pelagic fish, climate change in football fans. Not Aussie rules yet, but perhaps there's one being written for the Aussie rules. Climate change in common sense, climate change for dummies. Climate change in conflict, ethics, security, law, imagination, tourism. And there is one being written on climate change and masculinity. So climate change has reached into every domain, every area of human, creative, and intellectual and emotional engagement. It is truly a cultural phenomenon which can only be measured, I would suggest, and understood by deploying the huge and whole panoply of human investigative techniques. It cannot be understood by thermometers any longer. We also therefore need to see how climate change engages with the world's great religious faith traditions. Between 80 and 90% of the world's people self-affiliate with one of these religious faiths. And it's important to understand what is being said about climate change. In Australia a few years ago, this report Common Belief was published, 15 faith communities in Australia talking about climate change. In the American Evangelical Church, there is now a Evangelical Climate Initiative seeking to bring climate change down to the grassroots of American evangelical church congregations. We can also study climate change, and indeed need to study climate change, through the media. Max Boykoff has been doing a lot of the work, pioneering some of this work for a number of years now, and this is his index that is just as interesting as any index of global temperature, I suggest, showing in, again, a particular corpus of print newspapers in the major continental regions, how coverage, simply a volumetric index. And some of these spikes, of course, can be linked to particular events. Here is Tony Blair's climate diplomacy at work, the Gleneagles Summit, July 2005. His attempt to rehabilitate himself following the Iraq War. The IPCC Fourth Assessment Report in early 2007. Australia, the Garnaut Report on the Economics of Climate Change in Australia, 2008. And, of course, the twin events around Climategate in Copenhagen in December 2009. And we also clearly want to study climate change as it lives in the minds of individual citizens. And so survey work such as this from Tony Lysarowitz's group at Yale University and what he calls the six Americas, the alarmed, the concerned, the cautious, the disengaged, the doubtful, and the dismissive. And how these formative beliefs change over time. He's been doing this just over these last 2 years, and one can see reductions in those who would call themselves alarmed and concerned, and an increase in those who might affiliate with the doubtful and the dismissive. These are highly volatile formations of belief and attitude, and can change for apparently non-climate change related reasons. But nevertheless, we need to understand the dynamics that are at work in the way in which individual citizens engage or disengage. Or we might study climate change through the negotiations, as indeed some people have. They've followed the path around the world from Berlin to Cancun and are on the way to Durban already, probably. 16 years' worth of negotiations with politicians and diplomats, negotiators and lobbyists and advocates and journalists and scientists. And actually, one could argue that the value of these COPs annually is now as a meeting place for the world. It is not really about whether a post-Kyoto agreement can be negotiated. That isn't really what these COPs are about. In our contemporary world, actually, what these conferences of the parties offer is a way for the world to meet, a forum. But alongside all of this study that we might want to do to help understand what is going on with this idea of climate change, there is also another index which seems to matter, and it's this one, the Index of Global Carbon Emissions. Over this period of time, the emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from human-related activities has accelerated. At a time when the discourse has been seeking to decelerate that curve. The only thing that has actually managed to do that has been, of course, the global financial crisis in 2009. Emissions dropped significantly as a consequence of the contraction of parts of the global economy. So all of this material leads into and has fed into my own work and thinking about climate change, and therefore comes to a point in my book, Why We Disagree. The two questions when I set out to write this in 2007, why has climate change become the mother of all issues? Why, as George Monbiot would put it, one of our most salient environmental journalists in the United Kingdom, controlling climate change must become the project we put before all others. If we fail in this task, we fail in everything. Do you agree with that? Why is it that climate change is the thing that matters most? If we fail in climate change, we failed in everything. Why has it gained that ascendancy? And why, actually, has it also, though, been very, very difficult, apparently, to tackle? Why has that curve continued to go up? So let me move on to the second part, which is to then use this idea of framing and see how climate change looks through this particular set of lenses. The idea of framing has come out of social psychology and the communication sciences in the last 20 or 30 years. It's not a particularly sophisticated idea, I would suggest. In one sense, it's very intuitive and mundane. It's something that actually we do all the time in all of our communications, whether it's interpersonal communication or collective communication in society. It's a way of reducing or portraying complex issues and phenomena in such a way that certain elements are emphasized and other elements de-emphasized. And by doing that framing, it lends salience or attractiveness to different constituencies of our audiences. Certain responsibilities come to the foreground. Some solutions are placed in the background. It happens all the time. Here are two examples. In America, debates about gun policy. Is this a case of gun control? And all of the attendant attacks on civil liberties? Or is it about public health? It's about gun safety. How do you frame gun policy? Or genetically modified food. Is this about the next wave of food biotechnologies? Or is it actually introducing Frankenfood into the food system? Greenpeace's very successful reframing in the 1990s of GMOs in terms of Frankenfood, a very good case study. So with climate change, here are my six frames to offer you. That they're not, of course, exhaustive, and there are others that could be put into the mix. But these are six that I think have been very powerful and visible around the world in recent years. I'll say a word about each of these. Climate change as market failure, as technological hazard, as global injustice, as overconsumption. Climate change is mostly natural, and then climate change as a planetary tipping point. I'm not offering these in any hierarchical way, or even offering you an index of truth and falsity on them. They are six frames that are at work powerfully in our world today, and it's important that we recognise that. So climate change is a market failure. Nick Stern put his finger on it in his Stern Review in 2007. Front page of his 700-page report to Gordon Brown, who was then our Chancellor, in 2006. He said, climate change is the greatest example of market failure we've ever seen. So if that is what climate change is, then to remedy climate change, we have to correct the market. Or we have to create a market where a market does not exist, to allow at least the market to do its benign and benevolent work. And so we have in Europe the emissions trading scheme, as I've said already. Conor Hedegaard, a very influential figure in European climate politics, now the European Union climate minister. Climate change is a business opportunity. The carbon market is the key. A well-functioning and robust market with a long-term price signal is essential to redirect investments. And closer to home, Julia Gillard, I'm determined to price carbon. The time is right and the time is now. So it's clear, if climate change is market failure, these are the forms of policy interventions that do indeed need to be put into place. But we might also frame climate change as technological hazard, somewhat different framing, because here the focus is on what sociologists like Beck, Ulrich Beck and Anthony Giddens have talked about as manufactured risks. Risks that are inadvertent and unwanted consequences of particular and penetrative forms of human technology. Like asbestos or nuclear waste, like stratospheric ozone depletion, these are not natural. These risks were not known to the Greeks and to the Romans and to the ancient Chinese. But they're risks that are known to us because we have manufactured them. And if climate change is technological hazard, then we need to attend to the technologies directly. And we need to displace these harming technologies, those that depend on oil, coal and gas in particular. So Robert Sokolow and Stephen Packler, Princeton engineers, in their famous paper in Science in 2004 talked about stabilisation wedges, particular technologies that exist that simply need to be upscaled and rolled out, each of which can take 50 gigatons of carbon out of the trajectory for the next 30 years. Wedges by deploying these technologies at scale that we already have. Their argument is that these solutions are there, just waiting in the wings. Concentrated solar, wind turbines, nuclear, hydrogen fuel, and so on. But there are other ways of framing climate change as well. Climate change is framed by some as not a consequence of market failure, but as a outworking of the deep structural inequalities in the world's political and economic systems. It's climate change as global injustice. And here, one might use these sorts of maps, maps that show that just the proportion of people living on less than $10 a day, counterposed against the proportion of people living on more than $200 a day. And organisations such as Rising Tide, and there are many others, of course, who would adopt this position for them, here it's very clear. Climate change is a direct result of the economic domination of northern interests and transnational corporations. This isn't about market failure or even about technological hazard. This is about something much deeper. Or as Suzanne Jeffrey has recently written in the journal International Socialism, we need to ensure that those waging that battle on climate change recognise that the real enemy is the capitalist system, which puts profit before the lives of billions. And we need to recognise that the real allies in this battle are the millions of working people around the world who have no vested interest in the system that prioritises profit over the world's climate. So this is the frame. The policy interventions are going to be different. I could offer a number here, but let me just draw attention to this one, contraction and convergence, this framework that Aubrey Mayer has been promoting for 20 years now as an overarching ethical perspective within which climate policies need to emerge. The idea that when it comes to the global atmosphere, all humans are equal and therefore have equal rights of access to that global atmosphere, that global resource. Equal per capita emissions has to be the foundation for climate policy. And that has gained powerful advocates. Manmohan Singh, the Indian Prime Minister. Long-term convergence of per capita emissions is the only equitable basis for a global compact on climate change. So says the leader of 1.1 billion people. Climate change could also be framed as overconsumption. This has got a slightly different emphasis on what the problem is. We can use the IPAT heuristic that Paul Ehrlich and John Holdren introduced way back in the early 1970s. The impact of humanity on the planet is a function of population, affluence and technology. IPAT. T we've looked at already, technology. Here, overconsumption would say we either have got too many people on the planet and or those people are consuming too much. And here, if climate change is a function of overconsumption, the solutions become more radical. As Tim Jackson and his group at Surrey University have been working on now for a number of years, his report Prosperity Without Growth to the British government a few years ago, he says the easy compatibility between economic growth as conventionally measured through GDP and preventing climate change is an illusion. You can have 2% per annum growth in the global economy, as Nick Stern argued we needed over the next 200 years in the Stern Review. Yes, you can have 2% growth, but in which case you can't control climate change. Or you can have climate control. We can actually turn back that curve of CO2 emissions, as indeed we did in 2009. But you can only do that at the cost of conventional economic growth. And so this frame opens up stronger countercultural movements. The Dark Mountain Project here, Paul Kingsnorth, in the last year or two in the UK, has brought into being. The Dark Mountain Project is a cultural movement of people who have stopped believing in the conventional narrative about the future. We want to unweave the myths that underpin our civilization. Myths of human centrality, separation from something we call nature, of endless progress, the myth of our ability to control the planet. Or the other part of this IPAT, we're focused on population, and so we might have the Optimum Population Trust intervening and saying the most cost-effective policy measure is not feed-in tariffs for photovoltaics. The most cost-effective policy intervention is around free and open access to contraception for women who want it. £4 per tonne of CO2 avoided. That is a bargain. But we have other frames also powerfully at work around climate change. We have climate change as mostly natural. Ian Plimer here has put it very well. We've had huge climate change in the past. To think that the very slight variations measured today are a result of human activity is wrong. This is a powerful frame at work, particularly, it seems, in Anglo-Saxon cultures. And the policy interventions here that would be implied would be those that focused on adaptation to climate risk and climate danger. Whether it's about human-induced risks or naturally induced risks is actually less the issue. And so adaptation here in Australia, you have the National Climate Change Adaptation Research Facility. The World Meteorological Organization 2 years ago initiated a new venture, a global framework on climate services, where the focus was on using meteorological science from hourly forecasting through to multi-decadal forecasting to improve the ability of societies to cope with climate risk, period. Do we really want to get into the business of distinguishing between the victims of bad luck weather, act of God weather, who are excluded from the benefits of new adaptation funds, from those victims who are the result of so-called human-induced weather? Is that an ethical outcome that we actually want to endorse? And then finally, I offer this frame: climate change as planetary tipping point. The metaphor of tipping point introduced into Earth system science and climate change discourse by Jim Hansen in the back end of 2004, adopting Malcolm Gladwell's deployment of it in his book in 2000, The Tipping Point. These points in the Earth system, these elements in the Earth system which potentially could be either destabilized or transgressed in such a way that the system moves into a different configuration, never to be returned to its prior state. This is John Schellnhuber's map of where these potential tipping elements might be. And very quickly, this moved into wider political and social discourse. Tony Blair picked it up. We have just 10 to 15 years to avoid crossing catastrophic tipping points. That means we've now only got 5 to 10 years. And if this is the frame, then it clearly means that many of these other policy interventions are not going to be adequate. We can't wait for the carbon markets to work. We can't wait for the large-scale upscaling of low-carbon technologies. And if you think we're going to move away from GDP as the index of human performance, then you can dream on. Actually, what we have to do is to take matters directly into our own hands, so say the technologists and the climate scientists, some of them. We have to have technologies that can intervene directly with the planet. Mirrors in space, aerosols in the stratosphere, cloud whitening towers over the oceans. We have to be able to create a thermostat for the planet, as wonderfully depicted in this MIT symposium flyer. As someone pointed out to me, the hand is of a white middle-aged Caucasian male. Who controls the thermostat in this scenario? But this is an emerging discourse, and there is a growing set of activities within the science and technology community that actually would see this as a warranted program. So, six frames, six different forms of policy intervention around climate change. And again, I'm not adjudicating between these, and indeed, it's very important to note that of those six frames, five of them, I would suggest to you, have got no problem at all with working with the IPCC. Five of them would buy into the science as assessed by the IPCC. Probably frame five, there are many who would affiliate to frame five who perhaps would want to challenge elements of the IPCC. But the other five would certainly be quite happy, I suspect, to work with the IPCC as a starting point for the science. The science here is not the issue. The science will not adjudicate between which of those frames or policy frameworks is going to be most appropriate. And so this draws attention to the things that can adjudicate between those policy interventions. The different framings, and I suggest that all of you here today, when I've listed those six, you will gravitate instinctively toward one or two of them. or three or four of them, and away from one or two of them, or three or four of them. Because your own predispositions, your worldviews, your beliefs, your values, your attitudes, your cultural priors will be at work in sifting the evidence and in reconfiguring it in ways that are consistent with your own beliefs and preferences. And so this takes us into what we might call a cultural dynamics view of climate change. It's not a system dynamics, it's not an Earth system dynamics view of climate change now, it's a cultural dynamics view of climate change. And so in the cultural dynamics view of climate change, it actually matters who owns these voices. These are not just disembodied claims. We need to know that this is Julia Gillard, and we need to know something about where she's come from and where she's going. Or that this is Ian Plimer, or Tim Flannery, or Patrick Dodson, or Ross Garnaut. Who these people are matter when they intervene in public debates about climate change. As Andrew Hoffman at Michigan has stated, individuals' positions in ideologically based conflicts typically emerge from beliefs at the core of who they are. What they believe about the reality of the world, how the world behaves, what fundamental rights people have, their notions of justice, and what is right and wrong. And so it matters, or it should matter to you today, who I am speaking at you. So here I am. I'm saturated in English culture. I can't avoid that. I'm trained as an academic geographer, a critical realist, if you like, in terms of my epistemology, a practicing Christian, and a member of the British Labour Party. These are my prior commitments. What are yours? What are Julia Gillard's and Tim Flannery's and Patrick Dodson's? So why we disagree about climate change draws our attention to these deeper culturally placed positions. As social psychologists like Dan Kahan and colleagues who work with Dan Sarowitz have been working on the States recently, Sarowitz puts it this way, that different facts, different theories, different hypotheses around climate change that emerge from science that are relevant to people's own normative frameworks will be filtered differently. Or Kahan puts it even more bluntly, culture is prior to facts in the cognitive sense that what citizens believe about the empirical consequences derives from their cultural worldviews. This is an inconvenient truth, to coin a phrase. Not Al Gore's inconvenient truth, but an inconvenient truth, certainly for those of us who've been brought up with a sense of enlightened rationality as the final arbiter of how we should act and be in the world. This is an inconvenient truth that this is how people are. This is how they think, this is how they behave, this is what they believe, how they believe. And so drawing attention to this takes us into a different set of considerations around climate change, it seems to me. We need to move away from single cultures of knowing, for example, pure scientific rationalism and their attendant spokespersons, away from C.P. Snow's two cultures even. So Snow, of course, in his famous 59 lecture, counterposed the arts and the humanities against the sciences and gave a hierarchical evaluation of those two cultures. Or even beyond the three cultures that Jeremy Kagan, the Harvard psychologist, has written about very recently, this book, The Three Cultures, where he interjects the social sciences as a third cultural mode of knowing. Very, very good book. I'd strongly recommend it to you if you haven't read it. And as Kagan says here, that every society needs a cohort of intellectuals to check the dominance of a single perspective when its ideological hand becomes too heavy. Actually, there are four cultures that we need. This is what Matt Nisbet and his colleagues at the American University have recently written about in the context of climate change. The sciences, the creative arts, the social sciences, and philosophy and religion. And each of these four cultures of knowing have got something very important to bring to these debates. Technical data, models and scientific evidence, yes. Frames and mental models and understanding the human behavioural components. But we need the inspiration and the motivation of those amongst us who are able to put that into creative forms. And we need the deliberative and reflective insights that come from philosophy and religious practice that give us meaning and purpose and status in the world. And around climate change, therefore, they all contribute something. Science can tell us the ranges of forcing of different gases. I don't know of any religious tradition that is able to do that. We need the social sciences to understand these cultural filters that influence our cognition of risk. We need the aesthetics, the ability to imagine the future possible. And we need, I would say, the insights and intuitions that come from philosophy and religion that give us our status and our meaning and our purpose. And I would suggest I don't know any physical science that can do that, although Sam Harris recently would disagree with me in his book The Moral Landscape. But that's a different argument to have. So these different cultures of knowing, of being in the world, are important. They offer a different view of pluralism to this. This is one view of pluralism. On a one-dimensional axis about climate change, you have believers and you have deniers. And you can position yourself, and each of us in the room today, position yourself on that curve. You can do it, can't you? But that isn't really very helpful. It doesn't get us very far, does it? And I would suggest that these debates that we hear frequently, too frequently, are not really very helpful. A different view of pluralism would be this one, the circle. Or using Mary Douglas's cultural theory, the recognition that we position ourselves around this circle according to our cultural predispositions. And here, we actually all have got something important to contribute. And indeed, as Fiona herself has written in this project, in relation to museums, museum institutions must become spaces where conflicting views and options may be raised, examined, reflected, and discussed, and various actors assemble. Exactly. And climate change, surely climate change, demands that of us. It's consistent, too, with Eleanor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics last year, and her ideas of polycentrism. And here we move on to my second talk later today. What does this actually mean, then, in terms of policy? Some of the criticism that I got from my book, writing it, was that Hume has given up on policy. He says, oh, it's all too difficult, we've all got different views, it's all relative. Hume is just a quietist. He's turned his back on policy innovation. Well, no, I haven't. And so this afternoon's talk, drawing upon some of the thinking in the Hartwell group, which I've affiliated with, I'll explain how I think that the logic of my argument about climate change translates into a different way of structuring policy innovation. And Eleanor Ostrom and her polycentrism, moving away from unicentric approaches, would be part of that inspiration. But that is for the end of the afternoon, and I'll leave my talk here for now. Thank you.